The Speedmaster is an icon because it's everything a vintage watch should be. You want a steel bracelet, you want a black dial, you want hand wound. I mean, those three things alone, right? Like, what other watch that's in the modern world like fits those three things right now? You know, it is that good.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. Welcome back. It's 2021. We've got a new year, and we are not wasting any time on what was for many of us our first or second day back at work after the holidays. Omega dropped an absolute bomb as far as watch news goes with a brand new Speedmaster Professional Moonwatch. We've had tons of coverage of it over on the site, which I recommend you go check out. But I thought it'd be fun to start our first Hodinkee Radio episode out with Ben and Jack telling me what makes the new Moonwatch new, why it's such a big deal, and a little bit about what Omega has done over the last number of years to put them in a pretty unique position in the watch market. After that, I sit down with Cole and Danny to discuss a pair of stories that they've authored over the last few weeks that I personally really liked. For Cole, it's his in-depth review and video, his week on the wrist, with the Universal Genève Pole Router, which is a watch that has a special place in my heart, as you'll hear. And Cole gets into all the details here, why he wanted to go deep on this watch, what prospective collectors need to know, and kind of how he picked all the little things that went into making this really incredible package. For Danny, it's a very different kind of story. It's a story about how the Rolex Day-Date became the de facto starter watch for NBA players. I'm really happy to have sports back on TV, so if we can talk about sports and watches, sign me up. I'm never going to say no to that. And then to finish out the episode, we're going to bring you a narrative piece. This is the performance of a story that actor, watchmaker, and designer Aldous Hodge wrote for Volume 7 of the Hodinkee magazine. It's a story about how horology can sometimes be in service of something bigger, ideas, ideals, things like legacy and history. It's a really beautiful essay. I can't say any more than that, but please stick around to the end of the episode. This is one of my favorite things we've aired in quite a long time. So I think it's a pretty special way to end the episode, and we got a lot of fun stuff for you leading up to it. So without further ado, let's do this. Hey guys, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Steve.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. First pod recording of 2021.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen either of your beautiful faces.
It's January 7th when we're recording this. Yeah, it feels a little weird to sit down and talk about watches today, but that's what we're here to do. So
that's our job.
I'm quite eager to talk about watches, actually. Champing at the very bit.
that's fair, Jack. Well, we have a good watch to talk about. I mean, like, you know, the biggest news of 2021 in our world so far in the one short week we've had is the new Omega Speedmaster Moonwatch, which is about as big as watch news gets. So I thought I would have the two of you guys on as dedicated Speedmaster lovers to kind of walk us through what we got, why it matters, what people need to know. Like, really, I want this to be like a, if somebody's interested in the Speedmaster, like, hopefully they can listen to this and come away with everything they need to know.
We can do that.
So Jack, maybe since you wrote the story introducing the watch, do you want to maybe give us like the TLDR version of this? Like, what is the, what's the top level? Like, what did we get and why does it matter to you?
Well, so what we got was, this is the first really major technical update to the Speedmaster since the Caliber 321 was phased out in 68-69. And they started using the Caliber 861, and then in the late 90s rolled out the Caliber 1861. So both of those movements have seen pretty extensive use, along with the 321 in manned space flight. And they're all evolutions of the original Le Mans Omega prototype project, CH-27, which actually got started back in the 1940s. So it's, the history of the Moonwatch has really been, in terms of the movement anyway, has been about the sort of incremental evolution of this really kind of amazing chronograph movement that got its start you know, in the middle of the 20th century. And it's kind of amazing that, albeit extensively modified, it's still being used in manned spaceflight today.
So the movement's obviously huge news. It's the first time it's been updated in decades. But we also got some new design updates, right, Jack?
We did. And as with the movement, I'd be perfectly happy characterizing them as incremental. You know, certainly it looks like a moonwatch. It is a moonwatch. Some of the changes include the step dial, which I love. You know, it really gives some nice added depth and texture. The case is actually slightly thinner in the new version than in the originals. We still have a Hessellite and a Sapphire Sandwich model. We have some vintage adjacent details like the dot over 90. And we have a new bracelet, which is, I think, probably the most significant difference in terms of user experience. It looks great, feels great. The old original bracelet on the 1861 Speedmaster, you know, it was very well made, but it always felt a little heavy to me for the watch. And this one is lighter. It feels more flexible on the wrist. And I think it just looks fantastic with the watch.
Ben, what are your thoughts here? I mean, kind of when you first saw this watch, like we'd heard chatter that a new moonwatch was coming, but when this thing dropped earlier this week at like 6 a.m. Eastern time, what was your kind of gut reaction?
It's exactly what it should be. You know, it's just an evolution on arguably the most interesting kind of compelling modern watch there is in some way. The new caliber makes a big difference. The Meta certification, which I don't think people really understand in terms of what that really is. Like that to me is among the most kind of like ardent testers of, you know, kind of modern manufacturing and Swiss watchmaking for sure. I mean, it takes things to a level that is far beyond even what others that you might be thinking do in their testing. So, I mean, this is exactly what the moonwatch should be. You know, look, I have long said that the standard Hessellite, you know, closed case back professional is the best buy in watches at, you know, I think it's what, $700 more now, I think, with the new movement and new bracelet. I think it remains one of the best buys in watches. And I think what's so wonderful about this from like a watch purchasing perspective, which is, you know, I think that's probably my half of the conversation, whereas Jack is like the watch making perspective, you know, there's no BS here. And it's like, okay, you can't get it yet because they haven't made it yet. Like they're not in stores yet. So fair enough. But, you know, there are other iconic chronographs, the obvious ones, the Daytonas, basically let's just stick with the Daytona. That watch is awesome. I have one and I love it. But there's so much nonsense with it, with the secondary values and the gray market and dealers, you know, only giving them to the clients to spend $1 million a year, et cetera. You're never going to get that with the Moonwatch. And that's wonderful. And that's great. And I think the opportunity to walk into an Omega boutique or to come on Hodinkee and be able to say, like, I want this watch, I can afford it, I deserve it, this is what I want, I'm gonna get it tomorrow. That's a really wonderful thing. And there are very few icons left in the world of watchmaking where you can do that, right? All Rolex sports watches are out. You can't do that at all. Nautilus can't do that. Royal Oak can't do that. I mean, so the Speedmaster is kind of one of the few really kind of like A-level iconic sports watches, at the very least, that you can get whenever you want. And it might be the best one. Partly because of that, partly because it is at least, you know, half the price or less than any of the other watches I mentioned, at least in the chronograph world. So look, this is exactly what we deserved. You know, this is exactly what we wanted or what I wanted. There are those special edition Omegas out there that you still can't get in the 321 steel, the gold watch. You know, there are special editions here and there, but like the standard special watch, you in theory will be able to buy whatever you want. And that is a great thing from my perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, is that like this is a watch that is going to end up on what, tens of thousands of wrists in the next year, if not hundreds of thousands of wrists. Like this is a real thing that will like make a dent in the watch market. Correct. and be meaningful change.
That's exactly it. And it's like, I think, you know, we often forget, and this is, again, something I say often, so pardon me here, but like the watches that mean the most to people are the ones that are, you know, in this price category, right? Like usually less than $10,000. Anything above that, like people get a little kind of skittish about wearing every day. Some do anyway. In that price category, and you wear it every day, and you know that like if something goes wrong with it, it can be serviced, it can be fixed, and then whatever. Like these are the watches that become really special parts of people's lives. And I think the Speedmaster, to me, if I could criticize one thing about this watch, and I mean this sincerely, and again, I'm a very special case, but like I would love the standard Hessellite Speedmaster to come with the opportunity to get a blank case back so that you could engrave it easily. Because right now there's no room to engrave it. Like there's just too much on the case back. Engrave it and give to somebody as a gift or to myself or whoever. Like to me, this is a watch that will be as cool in 50 years as it is the day that it came out. And I would love to be able to engrave that watch. So like, if I genuinely think that's my only criticism of this watch in general.
Hey, Ben, I have a question for you. So we're at kind of a interesting inflection point in the history of the Speedmaster, where for at least for a little while, it's theoretically possible to choose between the outgoing 1861 and the incoming 3861. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, to me, look, there's so many people out there, like the old watches, are they better or worse? You know, from a watchmaking perspective, they're a little bit worse, or they just don't have these advantages that that the 3861 has. Will they ever be super valuable? I don't know. I mean, you know, if it were me, I would buy the brand new watch. You know, I mean, like I'm a believer in new watches should perform as well as they possibly can. And Omega has said, hey, we have advanced the capabilities of this watch, and it's $700 difference. If it were me, I would buy the new one for sure. Having said that, I know I'm sure there are people speculating that the old 1861s will pop in value or whatever. I'm wearing the Hodinkee Speedmaster right now and looking at it, and my dot is not over 90. And I was just wondering if there's a moment in time in the future where the dot over 90 will be looked down on. Will be like, hey, like I want the dot to the side of 90. You know, and I like the watchmakers are that dumb, and this world is that silly, where like that could definitely become a thing. But if it were me, I would buy the new watch all day. And look, I just might. You know, I own a vintage moon watch. I own a 2998, which is kind of a pre-moon. I might buy one of these, you know, just the standard Hezlite watches and wear it all the time as kind of a daily watch. Because again, it's like, it's the perfect watch to pass down to somebody to give as a gift, you know, to wear every day and just enjoy.
I mean, it's an interesting problem, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, you know, the 861, 1861 Speedmasters, those things have been flying, you know, going to space for 50 years. Yeah. And, you know, they're still up there on the ISS as we speak. On the other hand,
right,
you know, as a piece of equipment, as a, you know, practically speaking, there's absolutely no question that the new watch is technically superior. It's more accurate. It's tested more rigorously. The resistance to magnetism is just, there's no comparison to be made there at all. It's probably one of the toughest, most technically sophisticated hand-wound chronograph movements in the world right now. And, you know, you can still get it for an awfully reasonable price. You can get a watch with real history that is not a radical break with the past. I think it's still, it's an incremental upgrade, but that's what the entire history of the Speedmaster is about anyway. You know, and the bracelet's nicer.
Yeah. Lest we forget. I mean, look, exactly. And I think I remember a conversation I had with William Rohrer many years ago, William Cena, for those who know him by that name, I guess, you know, many 10 plus years ago. And we were talking about the Speedmaster, and he's like, hey, like the Speedmaster is an icon because it's everything a vintage watch should be. Like if you're a nerd like me, like you want a steel bracelet, you want a black dial, you want hand wound. I mean, those three things alone, right? Like what other watch that's in the modern world like fits those three things right now? You know, in this price category, like, can you think of another hand wound chronograph that is iconic, that has a black three register black dial on a bracelet in this range? I mean, forget the fact that it went to the goddamn moon. I mean, like, that's a whole other thing. But like, you know, even without the moon, if this were just a hand wound black dial steel chronograph on steel bracelet, and Omega had stopped making the Speedmaster 50 years ago and brought it out today, we'd all be like, this is the coolest watch ever. You know, it is that good. And I think that is what people often forget for a watch guy. Look, I mean, I'm wearing a hand wound Speedmaster right now. A hand wound chronograph to me, like that's watchmaking. Like that's a special thing. I obviously understand the value and kind of practicality of an automatic watch. But, you know, for a dork, which, you know, something tells me if you're listening to this podcast, like you probably identify as a dork in some way. Like the Speedmaster is pretty tough to beat.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, to both your points, like this watch came out, and despite the fact that I don't know, I probably see a Speedmaster more days than I don't just in this line of work. Like it is a thing I see probably 4 or 5 days a week. I still saw this and was like, oh shit, this is cool, you know? And that is that kind of like je ne sais quoi of this watch is not, I think, something we should undersell, how just like flat out cool it is.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The Speedmaster I'm wearing right now was my first, you know, good Swiss watch many years ago, when I finally started making a little money and I was able to afford it after wanting one since 1968, by the way. So like my best case scenario with the 1861 and the 3861 is I buy an extra 1861 because, you know, why not have, you know, one for rocking and one for stocking, and
all day.
And also buy a 3861. and that covers all the bases. And yeah.
So are you doing that? I mean, we can take a deposit right now, Jack.
Is Jack just hoarding Speedmasters now?
Yeah.
It's not really a practical decision. And, but in a perfect world, you know, if I suddenly found more change in the sofa cushions than could possibly exist there in a physically real world, that's what I would do.
The other thing that I want to bring up as, like, you know, kind of like the hardcore collector on the call here is, like, the two gold watches, the two gold versions of this watch.
Dude.
We've been waiting for this forever. I mean, forever, you know, and it's one of the moonshine was awesome. I mean, that was among one of the cooler watches to come out in the last few years. I think the standard non-limited one may be better looking, you know, without the little zirconium thing or whatever is on the dial, black dial. I mean, it really looks like a gold chronograph on gold bracelet. The white gold is a killer. The cannabis gold, Canopus?
I think it's Canopus.
Not cannabis. It's not cannabis, right?
You can pronounce it that way.
I mean, these are awesome. And these speak to a totally different type of person. You know, the guy like me, frankly, the guy who's got some watches for sure. And it's kind of been around the block with Speedmaster a few times. These are awesome, awesome watches. And they have the same bracelet, same movement, same everything. And again, I don't know how available these are going to be. You know, these are, I believe, boutique only, or at least the Sedna Gold is boutique only.
Yeah.
But, you know, They're really compelling, beautifully made, beautifully designed watches that are right in line with what you would see from Daytona or something like that. And again, it's just, as a guy who, as the community even, you know, loves to poke fun of me about it, like, I love the Daytona. There's no question about that. But the Speedmaster is just purer. It just is. You know, it is just, there's no BS there. And I really appreciate that about it, even in the gold versions, I hope, anyway.
Yeah, I gotta say, honestly, you know, even in a world very different from this one, where, you know, cross-shopping Daytona versus a new, you know, one of the new Speedmasters was a real option instead of a theoretical one, they're just such different watches. They have a completely different completely different history, you know, completely different reasons for liking them. And, you know, the same person can love both, absolutely love both, but just for completely different reasons.
Exactly right. And I think that they say dramatically different things about their wear to me. You know, I can't say what they say to other people, but, like, if I saw a guy wearing a gold Daytona, I would think one thing. If I saw a guy wearing a gold Speedmaster, I would think something else entirely. And I'm not saying one is better than the worst. And again, to be clear, I own a gold Daytona, so I'm not speaking ill of it. But it's just a dramatically different mood. You know, it's a different aura. The energy is different.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And again, the Speedmaster just feels a little bit more pure to me.
I wanted to ask you, you know, we're comparing the Speedy and the Daytona, which is obvious for lots of reasons. But the other thing I want to compare is the Speedmaster and the Submariner, because to get huge revamps of both of those watches in, you know, I guess less than 12 months is a pretty big deal. Like, I think those are probably two of the five most important, probably two of the three most important watches of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And I think it's telling that both Rolex and Omega revamped these watches, but did it in a sort of conservative, quiet, iterative way, as opposed to doing something crazy or going for some, like, you know, heritage model or whatever. And I wonder if you guys think that is that a path forward for kind of keeping these types of watches interesting, or is there something else we could see in the future?
Well, I'll happily go first here. So, you know, as you guys know, I write the monthly watch column for GQ, and when they were like, hey, what are the two watches of the year, right? I mean, I was like, okay, there's some crazy Royal Oaks and Richard Mille's and all that, but, like, to me, it was the 321 Speedmaster and the new Submariner. That is the ultimate two watch collection. I think this watch would replace the 321 as kind of like the watch to have if you're going to do two. But I think that the simple truth here, Stephen, is, like, there's a reason, like, Porsche makes the Taycan, the electric car. There's a reason they didn't put that in the 911 first. You know what I mean? It's like there are certain legacies that you just don't mess with, at least out of the gate, in a dramatic way. I'm sure there will be an electric 911 at some point after they've worked out all the kinks and, you know, done all the testing, et cetera. But the Submariner and the Speedmaster are those, as you said. I mean, I think you're right. I think these are probably two of the top three most important kind of, like, commercial watches in the world, certainly for our community. And, you know, why mess with success? Those are both dramatic, significant portions of each respective company's, kind of commercial ambitions each year. And they're working. And by the way, like, you know, look, I mean, as you guys all know, like, we're an authorized dealer for Omega. We sell new moon watches all freaking day, every day. You know, it doesn't matter if it's a Friday or a Tuesday, if it's a holiday or not, like people buy those watches every day. The same would be true for a Datejust or a Submariner back when you could get those, et cetera. So no one's looking to mess with that formula at all. And I love to see it because, you know, we see so many outlandish kind of iterations of icons, you know, over the years. And then these are just pure. And both of them were executed perfectly from my perspective.
Stephen, you did a lot of our coverage of the new Submariner, and now we have the new Speedmaster coming out. And, you know, it's interesting because they both represent movement upgrades with very, very, very subtle physical upgrades. Like, do you see a parallel there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really similar strategy. And what kind of surprises me about it, I think each of these watches in isolation, it makes perfect sense. Like Ben said, like, why would you mess with success here? Why would you risk kind of like upsetting the apple cart here? But I think it's strange to me to see Omega and Rolex kind of take the same approach with their two biggest icons, because I think over the last couple of years, we've seen those two brands take very different approaches. I mean, Rolex has been the much more conservative, slower moving. I mean, like, you know, we talk about this on this show all the time, but like for the 50th anniversary of the Daytona, like we did not get the steel watch that we thought we were all going to get. That took another year or two. You know, we don't always get the kind of like fan service, like straight down the middle answer from Rolex. We get these slow, conservative, like business minded almost kind of answer. Whereas Omega has really been in the business of servicing the community and keeping enthusiasts happy and releasing special editions and vintage throwbacks and all of this stuff. So I'm not surprised to see either of these watches treated this way, but seeing them side by side, it's interesting to see Rolex and Omega kind of attack the problem the same way.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, you know. I mean, both of those watches would be a great one watch collection.
Yeah, I mean you can't really do better than either of those watches.
Yeah, I think you nailed it, Stephen. And you know, I would encourage folks to go back to the conversation we had with Reynald at H10, who's the CEO of Omega. I don't know of another brand or another man, frankly, who does what you just said, Stephen, better, right? They are a massive brand. And I think people tend to forget because, you know, the U.S. in particular is so kind of like Rolex centric, you know, like it's Rolex or nothing to so many people. Omega is the second biggest brand in the watch world, right? I mean, they sponsor the goddamn Olympics, right? They sponsor James Bond. They've got Cindy Crawford as an ambassador. By the way, I'm very jealous that you got to do that podcast. you know, it's like they are a massive brand. These are not like an underdog in any way. It's a multi-billion dollar brand. They're bigger than Rolex in parts of Asia, even in Europe as well, and in certain places. Like, this is a huge brand, and they do things very differently. And I think the fact that, for example, that Reynald was nice enough to fly to New York to appear at H10, along with a few other folks in the industry for sure, like that says a lot. Like, you know, that video, I don't know, hasn't been viewed by that many people, but that he understands how important the watch community is to not only Omega, but to watches in general. And Rolex, if I can say, I don't think needs that. And I think they understand how important the enthusiast market is, but I think they believe that because the brand is so strong, and it is in the US at the very least, they don't need to kind of to do the things that the community really cares about. And sometimes it almost feels, you know, you're referencing the Platinum watch for the 50th anniversary, it almost feels like they're kind of like screwing with you a little bit. Like, just like, yeah, you deserve a steel watch for the 50th anniversary. Everybody would love one. And like, no, we're going to give you an ice baby blue dial with a brown ceramic bezel in platinum for $75,000. And like, you know, it's funny. And it's just like, this is just part of the world in which we live and operate. But I think Omega does that spectacularly well, where they can sell Constellations in mass to tourists, just like Rolex sells Datejust in mass to tourists. But they also, you know, pay attention to what the geeks want, you know, the nerds, the Jack Forsters of the world. And I think that's really a special attribute of Omega for sure. And to be clear, they don't need to do that. They really don't. Like, they're doing just fine, you know? And I think it's really says a lot about their leadership that they do it.
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting point, Ben. And I sort of feel like this kind of characterological difference between the approaches that these two brands take. You know, this goes back years and years and years and years. I mean, Omega's always been, you know, the brand that seems to have a little bit more willingness to play around with design, to introduce new SKUs, float stuff on the market, see what works and what doesn't. And, you know, you see I think you pick any given year, there's probably a broader product offering from Omega than there is from Rolex. We know, so you have this one brand which has chosen incremental improvements on a few core models, or relatively few core models. And on the other hand, you have a company which historically has done a huge, huge range of watchmaking and has never really abandoned any of the basic sort of collection verticals that it has.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And I think, you know, there's so many things that these kind of like, I don't know if the word is trope or not, but like these ideas that people just believe to be true without actually kind of like looking at the numbers themselves. And I mentioned one in the story I wrote a few weeks ago about the Philips result, right? Like everyone thinks you buy a Patek, it's going to go up in value. Like that's just objectively inaccurate, right? You buy a Nautilus at retail, it might go up in value, and it will. Buy a Calatrava, a complication, any real complication, it does not go up in value. You know, and so my idea was that, you know, buy percentage of collection that Longas might actually be better investments if that's what you care about than Pateks. Is that true? I don't know, but it's worth exploring. Similarly, I mean, I was reading James Stacey's great story, the buyer's guide to the new Speedmaster today, and somebody's like, I can't believe how many limited editions there are, how many different versions of the Speedmaster. Take a look at how many different versions of the Datejust exist. I guarantee you it is significantly higher than the number of Speedmasters. Like I guarantee it. You know, we don't, it's not called a limited edition or anything like that, but like the iteration that Rolex has done on Datejust or Date-8 or any of these things is dramatic. It's the core of their collection. You know, we talk about this all the time that like the number one selling Rolex in history, we believe, unconfirmed, but we believe, is the two-tone ladies Datejust. That is the foundation of Rolex's success. What's the foundation of Omega's success? It's not Speedmaster, not in the US anyway, but it could be. And I think that is the way that they treat it. Like they iterate on it so that it becomes kind of the blanket that represents the meat of their market. And so again, I understand it's like there's a lot more press releases from Omega about limited edition watches. But if you view them all as just iterations on a family line, I would almost guarantee you that there are more Datejust in this world than Speedmasters.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a kind of a flat-footed thing to point out, but the other thing is they sell them, you know? I mean,
absolutely.
You know, the most recent Snoopy, good luck.
Yeah, good luck. The most interesting thing that Reynald has told us, I think, in that H10 discussion was, you know, I kind of prodded him a little bit on the James Bond stuff, right? Like, we all love James Bond. There's no question about that. Nobody would say otherwise. We all love Omega. For some reason, our community doesn't jive with the James Bond Omegas. Like, it's just, it feels a little too on the nose, or I don't know, something. And I brought that up in H10. He said, you know what? Like, that is, we see dramatic upticks in sell-through across the family every time a James Bond movie comes out. You know? And so it's just like, there's this community that is very, very opinionated, and then there's reality. You know, and I think, you know, when you look at stuff like that, so if you're the global CEO of a multi-billion dollar brand and you have an affiliation with arguably the coolest character in modern literature, James Bond, why wouldn't you push that? Especially if it brings you double digit sales growth every time the movie comes out, you know?
I think one of the things that stands out to me, and I think you've both touched on it here, is Omega does a really good job threading that needle. And I think that might be a good place for us to kind of wrap this conversation is, they manage to do the big stuff. They do the Olympics. They do James Bond. They produce, you know, the Constellation and sell them in droves. But they can also make a 321 Speedmaster or a new Hessellite Moonwatch. And the enthusiasts go crazy. And like nobody, I don't know anyone, and you know, maybe you guys do. I don't know any like real watch lovers who, when the new James Bond watch comes out, even if it's something they're not interested in at all, like nobody looks at that and goes like, ugh, I kind of like, it makes me like my Speedmaster less, you know? Nobody thinks that. Like they can do both, and that's our, I think, unique strength for them in this world.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right, so to finish things up, I got to ask, now that we have these new moon watches, if either of you could have any Speedmaster that's currently available, it can be a moon watch, it can be the 321, it can be anything. Price isn't a factor here. You just get one Speedmaster to wear day in, day out. Which one are you guys rocking?
So let me ask you some questions. Is this the only watch you're going to wear for the rest of your life, or is this just like one that's going to slot into your current collection?
Let's say it's your current collection. Let's say it's in your current collection. But you're going to really wear it. It's not sitting in a safe.
Jack?
Well, I already own an 1861, and for all that I'd like to sort of fantasize about hoarding them, practically speaking, and you know, just in terms of, I would probably want a new 3861 at this point. Number one, I already have an 1861, and number two, like, my big fear was that it would feel that adopting the 3861 would feel too disruptive. It would feel like a break with the Moonwatch tradition, but it doesn't. You know, the longer I look at the movement, the more I sort of realize, okay, this is like one in a series of incremental improvements, changes that have been made in this movement over a period, you know, starting in 1947 and going all the way up to the present day. And it doesn't feel like a break with the past. It is still a flight qualified, Speedmaster with, all the tactical improvements that you could possibly desire. And I think as a daily wearer, it's very, very hard to beat.
For me, slotting into current collection, it would be the white gold Canopus new 3861. If you had said this is one watch you have to wear for the rest of your life, like kind of every day, it would have been the steel Ed White 321 for sure.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of a toss-up between the steel 321 Ed White and the 3861 Hesalite. I will embarrassingly admit, I think I've probably admitted this on the show before, but I have never owned a Speedmaster, which I know is like a major watch guy sin, especially as a space nerd. I've just like never found the one that I really want, that like when I put it on, I'm like, oh, I need this. But I've been feeling that way lately, and I've definitely spent a lot of time reading Jack's many, many Speedmaster stories. So I think either one of those would make me a very happy person.
Yeah, I think the one thing, and sorry to kind of take a sidebar here, but it got me thinking, because I was thinking about what Speedmaster could I see on Stephen J. Pulvern's wrist? And to me, it probably is like First Omega in Space, the smaller, 39.7 millimeter case, which is what I'm wearing. Let's talk a little bit about the First Omega in Space. Right? I mean, that is actually, I can tell you, I'll give you a little behind the curtain, that is actually the Hodinkee Shop's number one selling Omega. That watch goes like crazy. And that does not come on a bracelet, smaller case, et cetera. So that, we believe, right, Jack, is the last in production Speedmaster that has the 1861 in it?
Yeah, that is correct as far as I know.
That to me feels, because like they're always going to make the Hesalite and the Sandwich, the 42 millimeter curved lugs. They're always going to do that. They don't necessarily always have to make the First Omega in Space, especially now that they're using similar case in the 321, the Ed White style. So I know nothing sincerely, but it feels like the First Omega in Space could be an interesting play for those looking for something that like might be discontinued and might not come back anytime soon. Might not be replaced with anything soon.
That's a really interesting alternative. Also, by the way, just to backtrack a little bit, when you posed this question to us, Stephen, I was just thinking about the four new models that were released, and I forgot all about the 321. So can I have a do-over?
sure, Jack. We'll sit down and do the whole thing over.
I actually, now, to be, I got to be completely honest, for a daily wear, just because I am kind of a little bit of a precision fanatic, and I really like what the 3861 represents. I would still have a really hard time choosing between the two, but I suspect if push came to shove, I don't know.
Jack just wants all the Speedmasters. That's the moral of the story today, is Jack needs all the Speedmasters.
That's the problem. I want the damn Snoopy that you can't get anymore with this little spaceship that goes around the moon.
Awesome. Well, thanks for doing this, guys. What a hell of a way to start 2021, man. New Moonwatch.
New Moonwatch.
Yeah. It's a whole new year.
And up next, we've got my conversation with Cole and Danny about the Universal Geneve Pole Router and why the Day-Date is so popular in the NBA. Hey, guys. How you doing? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Steven. Hey, Cole.
Danny, Steven, welcome to 2021. Off to a great start.
I know, man. It's wild. Well, cool. Well, thank you guys for joining me. I thought we're kicking the year off. We're just talking through some fun stories that have appeared on the site. Weirdly, like kind of a big start to the watch world less than a week into the year. But yeah, I just thought it'd be fun to have both of you on, talk about a story that each of you has written recently, and kind of get a little roundtable going here. Does that work for you guys?
Yeah, I think I could manage that.
Perfect.
Whatever you say goes, Steven. Whatever you say, I'm here for it.
This is why I love the pod. Here, I'm the boss here. Everybody falls into line. It's amazing. All right, let's start things off with a story that we've been talking about this one for a while, and I'm super glad we finally got it out the door and in the way we did. And that's Cole's week on the wrist. It's a vintage week on the wrist, and it's with the Universal Genève pole router. Maybe let's have Cole start by giving us a sense of, like, why the pole router? Like, when we were sitting around a table brainstorming vintage watches to do weeks on the wrist with, why the pole router?
The thesis of the week on the wrist is that the pole router is a great place to start in vintage watches, and it's also emblematic of everything that we love about vintage watches. And there's plenty of meat on the bone to dig into when it comes to this watch. It has totally. An incredible amount of lore. It's a watch that a lot of people find their way into vintage with, and it's one that I actually like kind of have a personal connection to because of the aviation backstory. So I was a huge proponent of getting this week, and then it's done. So I think that's kind of why the pole router, and why now, I guess even further, is that finally we're at the space where we have some room, some latitude to experiment. So this video is a little bit different. The tone, feel, mood of it is a little more fun and lively. And we thought with Week on the Wrist Vintage Edition, this would be a great time to experiment and try something new. So this is the perfect watch to do it with.
Yeah, I'll peel the curtain back here a little bit. People may know this story already, but, you know, as I was watching the video toward the end, you kind of say, like, this is a perfect place to start for somebody interested in vintage watches, that they're reasonably priced, they have real history. And I'll admit, that's where I started with vintage watches. When I was a graduate student, working as a journalist part-time, I knew very little about watches. I read Hodinkee. This was 2011, I guess. I knew I wanted a watch to celebrate when I got my master's degree. I knew I wanted something with some history. I was looking at things like Omega Seamasters. I was looking at, kind of fantasizing maybe about a Datejust, but that was way beyond my budget at the time. Looking at some Tudors, all these things. And one day I stumbled upon the pole router, and I remember seeing it for the first time and being like, I can afford this, you know? And at the time I was looking to spend about $1,000, and I saved up all year for it. You know, I set money aside from all my paychecks at my part-time job at the university press. And like, it was big deal for me. And I ended up buying one, funnily enough, ended up buying it through somebody Ben knows right as I was starting at Hodinkee. But I still have the watch. I wore it at my wedding. I absolutely love it. And I have one of the, steel twisted lug, asymmetrical date window, micro rotor movement, like the real classic pole router date model. And that watch still, to me, you know, now it's one of the less expensive watches in my collection. And it is still, like, every time I look at it and wear it, it just puts such a smile on my face.
It's a powerful watch. I mean, and a lot of people feel that way. And I think after this video came out, what I thought was most interesting about this is, while your story is unique, it's also a pretty common scenario for people to find their way in, right? However, when the video came out, everyone was so laudatory. Thank you for shedding light on this, underappreciated watch. And I never actually thought it was that underappreciated. I didn't know that so many people thought it was a underrated watch. I thought it was an open secret how good it is. But it turns out, you know, a lot of people didn't know about the pole router. So you're a trendsetter. You're way, way ahead of your time, Stephen.
I don't think that's the case, because I found it somewhere. So as a neophyte, I had to have a leader. So I don't remember where I saw it, but it just has so much story to it. I mean, the connection to mid-century aviation, the fact that it was Gerald Genta's first real design. And, you know, for a kid who was like 22 and like living in a, you know, studio apartment on the south side of Chicago, like, you know, a Royal Oak was like, you might as well have asked me if I was going to buy myself a jet, you know, like that was just not anywhere in the conversation. But I could have that. And it's one of the first, if not the first, micro rotor movements. It's like, it's really an amazing little gem of mid-century watchmaking. And I think you did a really good job capturing that. And Davey, who produced the video, did a really amazing job of capturing that feel in the video as well. I wonder, Danny, Cole and I have kind of been going back and forth here, but like, what's your, experience with the pole router, if you haven't?
So I don't have a ton of experience with it, but I think based on what you were saying before, I equate it a lot to those vintage 34 millimeter Seamasters, which I've written about. To me, yeah. They're a similar aesthetic. They're of a similar era. There's so many of them, almost an innumerable variation, where you couldn't even do a reference points because I don't even think it's possible to track them all down. I think in the video, Cole, wasn't there thousands of different references or models in a certain subsection?
Just under 1,000. And that's using data that's extrapolated from serialized reference numbers, right? Serial numbers too. So We think there's around 1,000, yes.
And just to peel back the curtain one more step, I happened to run into Cole at Hodinkee HQ the day he was filming this, and I walked into the office. And of course, classic Cole, one of his week on the wrist, he's driving a race car. This one, I walk into the office and there's just hundreds of watches just out on a table for a week on the wrist, which generally speaking, we, feature one watch. And I'm thinking, of course, if Cole's doing this is an elevated version of whatever it is we're doing. And it was very impressive. When I saw it come together, because I heard rumblings, we hear some of the behind the scenes stuff of props we might need. And when I saw the whole aesthetic with the television and the computer and that whole sort of the whole theme, it was really incredible, Cole. It was so fun, honestly.
Thank you so much. There is one pretty interesting thing here. So to get that computer, this is a little backstory here. So I went on Craigslist and, typed like old computer or whatever. And
found, as one does.
Yeah, of course. So what we did is we used the screen as a green screen. So Davey did this. So Davey filmed the computer and then, superimposed old watch stuff on it. So to get the computer, I go to Craigslist, type in old computer, and find a props warehouse that supplied Broadway in Western New Jersey, out near the Pennsylvania border. And, I even lowballed the person, believe it or not. I threw out, a number, maybe half of what they were asking or something like that. And I went and I picked up that old computer. And because Broadway has been a bit dry and plays haven't been going on or whatever, they really wanted to unload the old computer. So that's the backstory of that thing. We went to a props warehouse, bought the computer, and used it for a week on the rest.
That's too funny. I want to know why you made a pretty significant choice here, which is, we talked about there's potentially almost 1,000 pole router models. There's dozens of them featured in the photography and the video. Why did you choose to highlight this particular gold pole router in the story? Because it's really the one at the center of things, and it's a gold pole router super with the black dial, the asymmetrical date window, signed crown. Why this one? Why was this the highlight for you?
So we borrowed the watches from a prominent collector in New York, and I went and I picked up a shopping bag full of a ton of precious metal pole routers, steel, everything, and we laid them all out and kind of came to a point where we're like, okay, well, we need to boil it down to one. A week on the wrist generally focuses on one. It's not weeks on the wrists and watches, right? So we had to pick one. And this execution, so once they were all out on the table, that one just, there was a moment where everything else faded away. And it was like a spotlight came down from heaven and shined right down on that watch. And Davey and I said, this is the one. This is the one that looks the best and is just really, really beautiful. And we picked that one to represent the pole router. The move would have been to go the execution you have. But we like to kind of switch it up. Plus, I think precious metal pole routers are, on the dopeness scale, are even more dope than stainless steel executions.
Dude, I'm not going to lie. Like, gold pole router was not on my radar when I was looking originally. It was steel all day. I'm kind of into the idea of a gold pole router. Like, I might have to add another one to my collection. I don't own I own one gold watch. It's a very tiny, thin Longines dress watch that belonged to my great grandfather. But otherwise, my collection is all steel and titanium.
And ceramic.
And ceramic. That's true. I kind of want a little yellow gold pole router now.
They're awesome. I mean, the gold to me also, unlike James, I'm not a gold stan. However, watches like that from the right period or whatever, gold really works and just shines. And this is a good example. Plus, the original SAS examples, the later of the SAS examples came in gold, in yellow gold, 18 karat. So that's kind of why too.
Yeah. Danny, I kind of want your take on this next thing. And it's, I think the pole router is an interesting watch because it illustrates a bigger point, which is that, you know, when this watch came out, it was kind of a sport watch. Like it served the same function as like a GMT Master. Like it was meant for pilots. It's a pilot's watch. Yet we look at it today and I think most people would describe it as a dress watch or a dressy watch. And I wonder how you think a watch like this maybe disrupts our notions of what a dress watch is versus what a sport watch is.
I think it comes down to size, why people say that. But ultimately, aesthetically, I'm going to bring it back to what I was talking about before with the Omega. I don't look at my Seamaster as a dress watch. Size-wise, it would be from afar, but the aesthetic choices made in the design of both of those watches are inherently meant to be everyday sport watches. I don't even know that they would have called them sport watches of their time or even tool watches, but they're not dress watches. They just aren't. There's something about the design of a dress watch that you look at it and you know, this was meant to be worn with a certain type of attire for a certain type of occasion. And these just scream the complete polar opposite of that. Now, I think it's cool to go against the grain and to wear watches that are not dress watches as dress watches. I think it helps when something is a smaller size, 33, 34, 35 millimeters. But I still couldn't, just based on aesthetic alone, I couldn't place it in that, you know, in that category.
Did you wear a tux for your wedding, Stephen?
I did not. I wore a suit.
Well, is it traditional or a suit or a tux? A suit, right?
Maybe. I mean, a tux would in theory be more traditional, but we did not do that formal of a wedding. It was a slightly more chill affair.
So you had to make exactly what Danny is talking about. You came to these crossroads. I'm getting married. I'm looking good. I have to wear a watch for this. And you chose the pole router. So let's turn it around to you. You have firsthand experience here. Did you consider it more as a dress watch to pair with your attire? Or I'm wearing a sports watch to my wedding?
Yeah, I definitely thought of it as a dress watch. And I mean, I have worn that watch on many straps over the years. I've worn it on NATOs. I've worn it on weird little beads of rice bracelets. Like I've basically any strap I own has probably been on that watch if it's the right size at some point. However, like I found one of these, like, you know, I took one of the textured calf straps that we sell in the shop in that sort of like light taupey gray color. You know, I was wearing a white shirt, navy suit, sort of a like earthy colored grenadine tie. And it felt like it worked. It was the right colors. It was the right feel. It was sort of dressy, but not too stuffy or dressed up. It was a vintage watch, but it wasn't one I had to worry about. Like, I didn't have to worry that if I had like one too many glasses of champagne that I was going to like ding it on something, you know, which was nice. I didn't have to sweat that out. But I think one of the strengths of the pole router, I think, is how versatile it is. And I still to this day think, like, you know, to your point, Cole, in the story, if you're a person looking to get into vintage watches and you want something that like has an entry level price point, but that 5, 10, 20 years from now, you're not going to be like, oh, that was cute. You know, like you're still going to love the watch. I don't know. I don't think there's anything better than a pole router. I still think it's one of the best watches ever made.
I'd agree with you.
Well, you know, let's maybe then end the discussion of the pole router there. I would say if anybody hasn't seen Cole's video, read the review, go do that. It's linked up in the show notes. But Danny, I wanna transition over to a story you wrote that was actually back before the holidays in December, and that was the story of how the Rolex Day-Date became the de facto NBA starter watch. Can you tell us like where the idea for this story came about? It's like not an obvious thing.
Not at all. I think I was having a conversation with Davey, and something just came up, and somebody asked, you know, what if there was like one watch that all NBA players wore? And for some reason, I'm a huge NBA junkie and I like live and breathe it. And I just said it like it was obvious. I was like, it's the day date. And I had no actual factual basis. I just knew that. And I needed to actually make sure that I was right about that. And luckily, it is the case. But it's a watch that I've always seen on every player. And it could be, you know, the larger model or the classic 36 millimeter size. But it's a watch I've seen everywhere from a rookie to LeBron to Michael Jordan. So when you're talking like that spread, I don't know who, I mean, in my article, I kind of get into, you know, maybe Michael Jordan had some level of influence on, you know, taste making for a lot of the players. But even if that's not necessarily the case, the watch, as we know, like speaks for itself. I mean, it has that kind of gravitas to it. And so, yeah, I mean, this purely came from me just spewing a fact that I figured I knew was right. And it turned out that it was. And it's just an awesome thing to see, because a lot of times with athletes, you see a lot more, you know, hot horology, super diamond encrusted, you know, bling pieces. And this watch is like fairly conservative. And most of the time they wear it in its most conservative state. And I find that to be pretty interesting too. So that's where the idea kind of originated.
The Day-Date toes this really strange line where, like, it is instantly recognizable and it's also not obnoxious. You know, like, in the same way that the Pole Router can be your first vintage watch for $1,000 and 10 years later you're still going to think it's amazing. Like, if you're an NBA player, like, you can buy a gold Day-Date when you're a rookie or when you finish your first season and, like, wear it when you retire and no one's going to be like, you couldn't find something better, you know, which I think is a tough thing. Like, very few watches and very few products in general have that kind of latitude. And I think that the Day-Date does, and for good reason.
It's also one of the most, if not the most, recognizable watch. I mean, I think a little bit of the Royal Oak, because from the bracelet alone, you can spot it, because there are, I think, rare examples of Datejust that have the presidential bracelet. I don't know if that's something that, you know, came stock original or those are special order. But for the most part, when you spot that, you're looking at a Day-Date. It's always precious metal. So it's what, and the dial design is, you know, an icon in its own right. So it's like, it's hitting all these levels. The entire watch, it's greater than the sum of its parts. And it's one of those things where, you know, from afar when you see it, what it is. And that's why I think it was so buried in my brain. But what really opened up the story for me, because you mentioned I'm in Bethesda now and I've lived in the DC area my whole life. I grew up, unfortunately, a Washington Wizards basketball fan, which is a really sad thing.
So sorry. That is
on a podcast.
Oof. Are they not around anymore?
No, they are. They're just sort of like, it's kind of like being a Knicks fan.
The fact that Cole was like, do they exist, is kind of the summary.
Well, I'm wondering why.
To put it in context, the Harlem Globetrotters win every game that they play, and they always play the Washington Generals. So just like Washington basketball in general just doesn't have good connotation to it. We're like that classic, we're cursed, you know, like we think we're cursed every year, even though we're not. It's just that we suck. Anyway, getting back to the story. About 3 years ago, John Wall, who used to be a point guard for the Wizards, he was our franchise player. And around Christmas time, a story ran in the Washington Post and a few other places where he showed up to a team breakfast with 15 Rolex boxes and just proceeded to hand them out to every single one of his teammates. And he bought every single teammate a president. He bought them all Day-Dates for Christmas. And a lot of the players on our team at the time were like, you know, not even on guaranteed contracts. A lot of them were rookies or really young players. And not to say that NBA contracts aren't huge, you know, off the bat. But still, they're not, you know, their financial future isn't secure. So they're not going to be the types of people that are just going to go spend all of their money, because they're going sort of from contract to contract. It was a huge thing. A lot of them, it was their first watch. And it was the first time that I saw mainstream coverage of watches and sports kind of coincide. Mm. And for the rest of that season, every time the players walked, you know, into the locker room, they do this sort of tunnel walk. And there's all these photos of the players. They're putting on their best clothes, kind of dressing in their best fits, their best sneakers, all that stuff. But every single one was wearing the Day-Date that they got from John Wall throughout the whole season. And I think that's a team bonding thing. I think it goes to the heart of what watches mean, you know, as gifts when you get them from somebody, that they're much more meaningful when there's a story behind them. They're much more meaningful than just the gold they're made of, than just the price tag that's on them. It really was something. You see players wear different stuff all the time, but I will tell you from the unreasonable amount of attention I paid to the Washington Wizards that season, that they all wore the day-date, that specific day-date, and a lot of them still do. And I think that's just an incredible testament to that watch, to be honest with you, and just to watches in general.
That's incredible. I love that so much. One of the things that stood out from the story to me is this quote you have from Kevin Love that I wanted to know if you could give us more context for. And that's that when asked about his why he wears a day date, he says, "It's a reminder that I don't have a Paul Newman." And I love that. And I think that could be interpreted a couple different ways. So I kind of wonder, how do you think it was meant? And can you give us a little bit of context there for that?
So when I saw that, it was actually a video, and he says it in such a defeated fashion. He says he almost like lets out a sigh. It's almost like, it's a reminder I don't have a Paul Newman Daytona. And he kind of just like puts the watch down and wants to move on with the conversation. And you can tell it hurts. It's like painful for him. And it's like the pain of a real watch enthusiast that kind of knows what he's doing, knows what he wants, and knows he doesn't have it. And that could be a situation of, I'm sure he has access to Paul Newman Daytonas, you know, and he definitely has the means, but maybe there's a specific one he really wants. You know what I mean? Like there's only one, and when that comes up, he'll get it. Interestingly enough, literally, I think either a day before the story ran or 3 days after the story ran, Kevin Love did an Architectural Digest tour of his New York apartment, and what's on his wrist? A Paul Newman Daytona.
What?
Yeah.
No way.
He's holding out on us, man.
I know.
Ah.
All right. So I figured that would be good to drop here. So if anyone wants to go check out that video, he's wearing it throughout the whole tour, and you spot it when he gives when he goes and gives a tour of his closet. You can see it in full view. I don't think he had it in that original interview. I think this was an acquisition that happened, you know, somewhere down the line, because there was a good 18 months between these two things, I would say.
Who does Kevin Love play for?
So he plays for another unfortunate franchise, the Cleveland Cavaliers. And he kind of got stranded in Cleveland. I'll put it that way.
Did he have a good season? Is that why he bought the watch? Did the Cavaliers?
No, so he's been a well-paid player. I'll put it that way.
Okay. Okay.
Also, for all who don't know, Kevin Love is the nephew of Beach Boy Mike Love. And
wait, what?
You know, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Danny's just coming in, just dropping mad trivia on us today.
Yeah, so he's got some good Beach Boy connection. Mike Love, in terms of like Beach Boys, probably my least favorite, maybe one of my least favorite, you know, 60s era musicians, but also a Daytona wearer. So there's a good little watch bridge between the two of them.
Wow.
Okay.
Sorry, Mike. I wonder if you're listening.
If he's listening, get him on the show. Kevin Love, if you're listening, come on the pod. Danny will grill you about Paul Newman's and day dates.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to know, have you spotted any good watches this NBA season? And this question is open to both of you, but I'm guessing Cole's not watching too much basketball based on the questions that have been asked. But I haven't seen anything crazy yet. And I haven't watched a ton of basketball yet this year, but I wonder if you've seen anything good either courtside or before or after games.
So I've noticed Draymond Green is known for wearing a white ceramic AP perpetual calendar, which is just an super cool watch. And that one sticks out like crazy. But then the craziest one for me this season, you wrote about the AP, the black ceramic, the open work dial. So LeBron was wearing that one. And what I love about that is I'm pretty sure LeBron at one point was an AP ambassador, but to my knowledge, no longer is. So he's a watch free agent. But it just shows like, A, he's got the access to it, but B, it's just an awesome watch seeing him wear it. And so I think that was like maybe a couple of days after your article dropped, I noticed that it blew up on Instagram that he was wearing that, which was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. LeBron wearing that favorite, watch, that's a lot of like winning in one place.
Oh yeah. And there's a ton of, I mean, AP is pretty standard in the NBA, but my favorite watch situation in the NBA right now is the Curry family. So you got Steph Curry, obviously. You got Seth Curry, who's his lesser known brother, but still a really good current NBA player. And their dad, Del Curry, played in the NBA for like 10 or 12 years. So Steph, I think I mentioned him in the article, he wears a Day-Date, but he also is known for almost always wearing a Submariner, just standard steel sub, which you never see. Like, I would say of all watches to see on an NBA player, you would never see that. Mm. His dad wears the Batman, and his brother wears the Batman on Jubilee. So it's just like a solid trio. They know awesome. What they're doing. I'll put it that way. They know what they're doing. So
that's pretty cool.
That was cool for me.
I got to say, it's not current, but my favorite NBA watch spotting of all time is Michael Jordan wearing that Urwerk courtside.
Yes.
I just like anytime we're talking about basketball and watches, I know this is like not newsy. I'm not bringing anything new to the table here, but like, as we were, you know, prepping for this, I just kept coming back to that. And it's just like to see somebody that important and that like culturally keyed in, wearing a watch like that is just like my brain kind of melts every single time. And I think, you know, you've already hit on the fact that there are many NBA players who are like really paying attention here and really into this. And I'm optimistic that we're going to continue to see more and more interesting watches, that these day dates are going to be jumping off points for people, and that we'll continue to see great day dates. Like no shade there at all. But like I'm waiting for the first time that, like, you know, somebody rolls up wearing something really funky, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that's what I love about the NBA is, unlike tennis or golf or a lot of the like, single individual player sports where sponsorships are the name of the game, the NBA is pretty dominated by shoe deals and apparel deals. So you'll have like Adidas, Puma, Nike, obviously, like across the board, but you don't have as many watch deals. And so watch spotting is a lot more interesting in the NBA because these are personal choices. This is like the real stuff that they're interested in, that they want to wear. Of course, there's some guys that have brand partnerships, but for the most part, it's organic stuff. And that's why I have a lot of fun checking those out. And whenever I can marry my love of watches in the NBA, it's a good day. So
also, you mentioned the Wizards. Jordan played for the Wizards at one point, right?
He did. He was also the general manager.
During that time is where, remember that Datagraph in-depth story?
Yeah,
I do. So I wrote that one.
Include that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he we'll wore a Datagraph.
Yeah, how big was a Datagraph? Was it like 38 millimeters or something? Like, I can't remember the original Datagraph.
I think the original is 39 and the new one's 41, I believe.
Still crazy for Michael Jordan to be rocking a 39 millimeter watch, I've got to say. Yes. I mean,
that would be like cool. Me wearing like a 28 millimeter watch.
Yeah.
You know, like that's no joke. Awesome. Well, thanks for doing this, guys. This was super fun. I just really enjoyed both these stories and selfishly wanted to like sit down and chit chat about them. So thanks for humoring me. And yeah, lots more to look forward to in 2021.
Awesome. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you, sir.
All right. And to take us home this week, we've got actor, designer, and watchmaker Aldous Hodge talking about how horology can be used to build a legacy.
Closing Thoughts by Aldous Hodge. My language is art, specifically the art of design, which I've plied with an obsessive passion that eventually became purpose. I remember drawing my first watch when I was either 18 or 19 years old, after I had just become a student at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California. It was a wooden wristwatch with a wooden cuff-style strap. I'm not sure if the design was any good. That's not important, though. What is important is the symbolism it carried. It wasn't until many years later that I was able to see the real value in that very distinct design. But I'll expound on that later. In my college classes, our primary focus was automotive and architectural work. But for some reason, my mind drifted towards horological design, which they didn't teach. So I taught myself. I became enthralled by the intricacies of watch movements and how they were composed. In my mind, designing movements was kind of like developing a Tom Kundig house and building a 351 Cobra engine inside of it. It seemed to make no sense, yet at the same time made all the sense in the world. I've been enamored with the freedom that the imagination of conception afforded me ever since I was 2 years old. I knew three things at a very young age. One, tomorrow isn't promised. Two, life isn't a fair game. And three, you must do your best in order to recognize and appreciate the blessings laid before you. I come from a beautifully spirited family. My siblings and I were raised between New York City, New Jersey, and California by our gorgeous and courageous mother, who wasn't always dealt a fair hand. She had a tremendously hard life, yet she always persevered. Even in the darkest times, like when we were living in our car, she was always and still is a champion who instilled her never give up fighting spirit in me. I knew that I wanted for us to live a better life one day and for my mother to be afforded the comfort she deserved. I never thought that I would ever earn enough money to buy a nice house or a car. I thought that if I designed it myself, I could build it. Proper education, both scholastic and cultural, was the key. It was also my mother's highest priority for us. This is one of the primary reasons I began sketching blueprints for houses at the age of 12. Mom took notice and put me into a mentorship program where I actually interned at an architecture firm between the ages of 13 and 15 years old. Little did I know how much that would influence my horological design aesthetic. She's also the reason I started college at 14, going through a few different institutions before landing at my favorite school, ACCD. This mentality of self-motivation came from the necessity to create an opportunity where there wasn't one, which is why I tell kids all the time, you're not a product of your environment. Your environment is a product of you. My desire to create was further galvanized by my environment's lack of recognition of who I was. I grew up in a country that told me, through subtle reinforcing factors, that I wasn't supposed to amount to much in life. Oftentimes, people who didn't look like me would take a guess at what they thought I wanted to be when I grew up. Scientist, doctor, engineer, or anything remotely associated with cerebrally motivated pursuits were never on their list, which was deeply insulting. The world I grew up in tried to teach me not to believe in my potential by beguiling me into not recognizing who I truly was. Were it not for the sagacity of my mother, I probably would have believed it. The most alarming environment was actually elementary school. I never saw myself reflected in the history books. Growing up, I loved inventors, and Leonardo da Vinci was one of my favorites. There were many accounts of his great feats. However, there weren't any for George Washington Carver, a black American inventor who created over 100 products derived from the peanut. Nor were there any acknowledgments of other black inventors whose designs greatly contributed to the ease of our daily lives, such as Garrett Morgan, the traffic light, 1923, Marie Van Britten Brown, the home security system, 1966, Alexander Miles, automatic elevator doors, 1887, or Sarah Boone, an improved ironing board, 1892, and the list goes on and on. That list reaches into the watchmaking field as well, specifically to Benjamin Banneker, a self-taught mathematician, astronomer, and horologist who is rarely mentioned in the horological world, yet another black inventor excluded from the history books. Here's a genius of a man who built his own clock from scratch in 1753. He borrowed his neighbor's pocket watch, took it apart, and drew each piece. He then utilized those sketches to carve out a wooden clock using just a knife. What a painstaking challenge that must have been. And then, to be able to calculate all of those ratios by his own determination, he was truly a savant. As a result, Banneker created the very first striking time device in America. It kept time and struck the hour for over 50 years until it was destroyed in a fire. It's astounding to me that the very first striking clock invented in North America was made by a black man. For a young black kid with engineering aspirations, to know this and see that representation is so very impactful. The fact that it was a wooden clock run by wooden gears was a strange coincidence. His creation resonated with me personally because when I think back to my very first watch sketch, the all-wooden wristwatch, It let me know that my efforts in this profession are connected to something bigger than design, bigger than watchmaking, and bigger than myself. I'm connected to legacy. This is more than just trying to build a watch. This is about building legacy. That is the primary motive for establishing my horology brand, A. Hodge Atelier. I hope that my brand will stand as a representation of all of the virtues that have been reaffirmed within me through my experience with horology. I wish to represent the strength of knowing one's true value, the power of perseverance and belief, and the necessity to educate oneself beyond what is placed in front of you. I aspire to develop educational horological programs for children and young adults, not only to learn the mechanical and scientific aspects of what we do, but also to develop the mental fortitude that is needed to succeed. Those aspirations are actually the inspiration behind the skeleton key I chose as the foundation for my logo. You see, skeleton keys were theoretically devised to bypass any lock. And I would like my brand to stand as a reminder that you can use your mind to bypass any of the world's locks, no matter what the challenge may be. I would like people to learn from my journey, my mistakes, failures, flaws and all, and successes. And I want them to see that it's worth it to never give up on yourself, especially in the face of adversity and naysayers. Horology has exposed me to so much wonderful life beyond my original scope. I've met so many incredible people, traveled to amazing countries, and learned about so many different cultures, so much history. I'm even learning a new language because of it. Most importantly, this journey has opened me up to a newfound purpose, and I wish to share what it has provided for me with many young people who are seeking that very thing. There's so much more to say, but the rest of this story will be told through legacy. For now, I'll end with the words of Nelson Mandela for anyone currently navigating through difficulties on their path to purpose. I don't lose. I either win or learn.